If you follow the news closely, that more than 6 months later, the world continued to pay attention or much closer attention to the war in Ukraine. On one hand, people are debating what measures or necessary steps that the international community can take today in order to stop the ruthless behavior of Vladimir Putin. But on the other hand, some people are grateful towards the war, especially the people who are in within this energy field, because they feel like this is the time that the world really need to pay attention regarding this energy crisis that we're facing. But meanwhile, what about the topic on nationalism? And how should we understand the word identity in the midst of the whole globalization? So that's why today, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to invite Dr. Rolf Schulhammer. And Rolf works as an assistant professor of international relations at Webster Vienna Private University. And his main field of research is political theory, with a particular emphasis on political psychology and a new institutionalism, as well as a regional focus on the United States. Now, Rolf, and welcome to The Missing Piece.
Thank you so much for having me, Will. I'm very excited about this.
Me too. I am so looking forward to our conversation. Now, let's get to our topic. I want to read something that you recently tweeted on social media, and you said, "Just a reminder, if you want to address climate change, nuclear is the answer. And if you are against the nuclear energy, I don't take you seriously on climate change, because obviously you don't take it seriously either." Rolf, again, as we mentioned before, when we look at the war in Ukraine, not only that we need to address this war from this political and also from this war perspective, but also because of the war, the whole world, it's on this track, which is energy crisis. Can you help us to understand, why did you decide to tweet regarding the climate change? And also, how does that even relate to nuclear at this moment?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. So I think this is a fantastic question. And if we kind of let's take it backwards, if you want, right? I mean, what I meant particularly by this tweet is, we know that when it comes particularly to CO2 emissions, right, nuclear is a very, very good option to reduce them. I mean, to give you one example, I mean, this is really something, by the way, where we have the hard numbers. So this is not, you know, a tea leaf reading or you know, kind of P times, you know, my thumb squared. So this is something where we have really, really good numbers. For example, the French, who in the past, unfortunately, they did not update them, right? They didn't as much for maintenance as they should have. But the French nuclear fleet and their heavy use of nuclear energy for electricity production made them the least CO2 intensive electricity producers in Europe, right? And the data is absolutely clear on this. Then if we compare, by the way, nuclear to solar farm, right? The CO2 equivalent is 4 times less for nuclear than for solar. And that's not me saying this, right? It's the IPCC, like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, at least supposedly the authority on everything related to the issue of climate change. So it's them who says this. So this is absolutely clear. So it strikes me always as a little odd, right, that so many of, let's say, the most outspoken proponents of, you know, there is a global climate crisis and, you know, all these youth movements, Fridays for Future, The Last Generation, Extinction Rebellion, right, that they all come out against nuclear energy, which would, at least for that particular field, a potential solution. I mean, personally, I find nuclear energy in many ways, and maybe we can go into more detail a little bit later, technologically wise, a miracle. It is very similar to, you can compare it to industrialized agriculture, right? I mean, the extent to which humanity managed to create food and energy is, again, I can only repeat myself, is miraculous. But now we seem to hamper and sabotage it for purely ideological reasons. And just to give you 2 quick examples here, you know, one of the reasons people say, you say, Fukushima, right? How can you be for nuclear energy after what happened in Japan after Fukushima?
That's right.
Well, as far as the data goes, precisely one person died of nuclear radiation. I mean, that is still tragic, right? Every life lost is tragic.
That's right.
That should not be, that, like, we don't ban cars because of accidents, right? We didn't stop commercial air traffic because of plane crashes. Every life lost is a tragedy. But, you know, life and politics particularly is trade-offs. So in this case, I think the trade-off is still, in my argument, pro-nuclear. And even the Japanese just 2 days ago made a complete U-turn on their approach to nuclear energy. They're completely returning to nuclear energy. They want to restart their nuclear power plant. Well, the second one, of course, Chernobyl, right? I think there are also two things that are necessary to say. First of all, right. Chernobyl was built in the 1970s. Mm. So to say in 2022, we cannot build, you know, fourth generation nuclear power plants because a second generation 1970s power plant that was shoddily constructed by the Soviet Union in the 1970s, they had a coal meltdown. That's not an argument. That's like you saying in the 1990s, right, in 1992, I cannot fly commercial because there was a plane crash in 1940. Yes, but technology has advanced. And just as a reminder also to your listeners and to your viewers, the death toll, again, tragic, of course, every single life counts, but the death toll at Chernobyl was below 100 people. Mm. And the last reactor core in Chernobyl was turned off in 2000. So this is something nobody talks about. They kept the power plant running. So you have countries that had no nuclear accidents, right, that are highly advanced technologically, that have high standards in engineering, right? Germany is the best example here. Mm. And instead of investing more into this technology, they do less. And my suspicion is, and this is kind of, let's say, where my hat as a political psychologist comes in, this is an ideological thing. Right? Mm. There is no scientific justification for doing this. It can only be explained by psychological factors, and they're particularly that for many people in the West, and I'm sure we're going to touch on this in more detail in a second, but for many people, particularly in the West, right, opposition to nuclear energy, opposition to fossil fuels, I would even go so far and say opposition to the modern industrialized economy has become the core of their identity, right? And this is, of course, a problem because like every identity, you know, if you're a Muslim or a Jew, you don't eat bacon, right? If you are a devout Hindu, you don't eat beef, right? As a Buddhist, you're probably going to be vegetarian. And if you are a, you know, postmodern Western liberal, you reject nuclear and fossil and genetic engineering and pretty much everything that modern technology brought. So this is, it's a religion without God, but it's still, I would say, very religious in the way it expresses itself.
Rolf, you know, it's interesting that when I just listen to how you explain the importance or the significance of nuclear energy, but, you know, but put in a very simple way. Again, today, when we pay attention to the rhetoric, it regardless what nationalities or regardless what kind of background. But one thing that I guess you can agree with me, it's most of the politicians only talk the talk, but refuse to walk the walk. So in other words, they only pay attention to the things that actually matter to themselves. But meanwhile, that again, the topics such as nuclear plants and nuclear energy, this is something so crucial. But again, you are the political psychologist, and I want you to help us understand if this is something so fundamental, this is something so urgent, why do you think that when the leaders are getting together, for example, the G7 or the G20, you know, we name it, but few of the moments that actually touch on those matters, is it because it's too expensive? Is it because too scientifically advanced? Or is it because money just is not available at all? Help us understand.
I mean, I think it's a combination of all three of those. One thing is, and I say this with all carefulness now, so I don't want to be misunderstood here, but I think we have to touch on this as well. There is a certain weakness that comes from having democratic governments. Mm. And what I mean by this is, again, I'm a huge proponent of democratic governments for a variety of reasons. But of course, in this respect, right, politicians, but you can have two kinds of politicians, if I put it this way. But you can have a politician who says, democracy is a system in which I make my pitch to the population and I then try to convince the population of what I think is right, right? Because Margaret Thatcher once said, first you win the argument, then you win the election, right? This idea that democracy is an arena, a competition of ideas, and the best idea will win. That would be the ideal case. But then you have the second case, right, where the politician looks at the population, right, he kind of wets his finger and sticks it in the wind of public opinion and says, so what do the people think? And don't even think about, you know, is what they think correct or realistic, but just then, you know, kind of appeal to what the politician believes the people want to hear. So this is then, you could, maybe it's not a weakness of democracy, maybe you can call it an abuse of democracy. So in, so instead of exactly the argument you just made, instead of saying we need to have a debate about this, they go out and say 51% reject it. So I go out and say I reject it too, right? So I think this is a little bit a problem we have here. But you're also correct on the second count, which is even when they feel that they have to make commitments to certain ideas, to certain policies, whether they really do it is then very often another topic. Is it a problem of money? Well, depends which country we talk about. I mean, what we saw both in the US and Europe over the last 20 years, or let's say over the last 15 years, money was no object, right? We had quantitative easing, we had low interest rates, we had, you know, the money presses were turned on permanently. So could something have been done with all that money, sustainable, or let's say an investment in the future, for example, in the realm of energy? Absolutely. And it was partially done, but it was done in the wrong areas. I'm sure we're going to talk about this as well. You cannot power a modern industrialized economy with wind and solar. And just to give you one quick example, I think you're in Hong Kong at the moment, right? Am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then you're much closer to this than I am. But I just recently read about you know, semiconductor production in Taiwan, the newest generation of semiconductors, and they are tremendously electricity intensive in their production. I think by 2025, right, the semiconductor production alone in Taiwan will need as much energy, as much electricity as the entire country of Sri Lanka, right, with 21 million people is consuming. So this shows you how important electricity is, and you cannot supply such an industry and the rest of the country as well, right, with wind turbines and solar farms. You can't. It's unreliable. On good days, you might can, right? If you have a windy, cloudless, sunny day, right, then you can. But you need that energy 24/7, 365. And again, people in Taiwan know this. People in China know it. I mean, everybody, this is so unnerving in Europe. Everybody says, look at the Chinese. They're doing so much in renewables. Yes, they do. But as you probably know, they do even more with coal. They do even more with nuclear.
That's right.
Because the Chinese have realized this is not about one energy source versus another. It is as much energy as possible. And this is what people in Europe, politicians, but the population too, what they do not get, by the way, in the United States as well. This is not renewable versus nuclear versus fossil. This is, we need all the energy we can get because the future industries are electricity/energy intensive. And as long as we don't realize this, and as long as we don't have this conversation, I mean, let me be absolutely blunt here. And I think that think tankers and you yourself, I mean, they know this. They're just too polite to say this. This is particularly, again, for Europe, this is economic suicide. You cannot be a wealthy, industrialized, you know, spot on this earth without energy. And my big fear is that I love Europe. I mean, I live here. But my big fear is that we are completely missing the boat here, and which is understandable. I mean, imagine you're a company. And then you look to Europe, you know, strongly unionized, high labor costs, high energy costs, right? You know, lots of benefits for workers, right? Lots of vacation days. And then you look to China, right? Less vacation days, longer work weeks, and cheaper energy. I mean, why in the world would you continue to produce in Europe? And then you could say, well, but they need the European market. Well, do they? Right? I mean, a point will come where the Chinese domestic demand will also be, you know, maybe not strong enough, but they will be substantially in absorbing this. And then you have India. And I'm not sure, again, something the Europeans don't seem to grasp. I mean, the aging retirement home that Europe increasingly has become is simply going to be much less relevant for the global economy than it was 50, 60, or 100 years ago. So the Europeans kind of still, even those who are anti-colonial and anti-imperialist, they still look at the world as if they are the center of it, when large parts of the world are already kind of moving on. I mean, you see this now. I'm sorry for the monologue, but I mean, your questions are fantastic questions, and I think they deserve a detailed answer. You see this if you look at the Ukraine war. In the sense, India, China, Africa, South America, for them, this is simply not important, right? Mm. This doesn't make them pro-war, pro-Russia, but they don't really care about this, right? For India, the border with China is more important than the border between Ukraine and Russia. Right. And again, this is something Europeans don't understand. They say, but this is so important. Why does the world... Because for them, it isn't, right? Sudan, Egypt, Algeria, this is like, again, they watch it. They are pragmatic about it, right? They're agnostic about it. But this is not something that goes deeply to their sense of national interest or anything else. And we don't understand this. We still have this idea in Europe that what's important to us is important to everybody else. Mm-hmm. And this is also how we think about climate change. This is important to us. So everybody cares about it. No. Not to that extent. This is another last point in this. Nobody wants to destroy the environment, right? Nobody, again, I'm the first one to say, yeah, the planet is warming. So this is an issue. But the question is, and I think the answer by the Chinese and the Indians is better there. They say, this is true, but we're not going to condemn our people to eternal poverty. We're not going to drive our economy over a cliff to save the planet. They are not going to do this. And it strikes me that the Europeans particularly are more ready to do this than anybody else.
Rolf, I think just go along with what you said. Again, thank you so much for explaining all this in details. It's very insightful and also very much enlightening. But on the other hand, you know, as an international journalist that I travel extensively across the continent, one thing that just go along with what you said is the reason why some of the countries are not actually paying attention to the matters which actually played a significant role in some parts of the world. It's only what really boils down is the word politics. So in other words, do we really have to politicizing everything? Like, for example, when we look at the conflict between US and China at this moment, and of course, we look at this territorial dispute between China and India, and of course, and also the economic crisis in Sri Lanka, I'm sure that for every single major project that the countries I just mentioned, they all can chip in. They all can contribute to something to reduce the threat or reduce it at least to the minimum a level of the issue. But I'm sorry to say, in reality today, everything it's about politics and everything it's about individualism. Now, when we talk about individualism today, this is something that leads to our next question. Rolf, you recently comment on something regarding the political and also this energy crisis happening in Germany these days. If I'm not mistaken, that the German government, that demanding people, let me be careful, or asking people to cut back on their energy usage because the war in Ukraine and the entire world started to wake up to realize, oh, wait a minute, we are going to run out of energies. So what we can do is we are going to ask the citizens to take a step back regarding this energy efficiency. Now, Rolf, again, on one hand, I can see where the politicians are playing. But on the other hand, my question is very simple. Why, whenever there's a crisis in the world, the average citizen have to be the victims of the crisis? So in other words, why do we have to sacrifice so much in order to help others or in order to shoulder the responsibilities of others? Does that make sense?
No, it makes absolute sense. And I think you are touching on something that is crucially important, which is, to what extent, kind of what you just mentioned, to what extent are people willing to make the sacrifices, right? Mm. To kind of shoulder these issues and the problems you just described. And I think one crucial, I think that has two answers to this question. Right? One is, if people really feel, and this goes to your politicization question, if they feel this is like an asteroid on course on crashing into the planet, right? This is something hardly anybody could foresee this, right? Mm. So if politicians can say, this is an exceptional situation, this is something we weren't prepared for, now all of us must pull together to in whatever way, shape, or form to answer to the threat, I think then you will have solidarity by the people. If the people feel threatened, right, for example, in times of war, I think this is what you see in Russia at the moment a little bit, right, where the people seem to be coming closer to Putin and his regimes than falling off. So there are these scenarios where people show a certain willingness to shoulder these issues. But if, and I can't put a number on how many those are, I'm definitely one of them, and you sound like one as well, but who knows whether we are a majority or a minority in this. But if the reason for the problems we are facing now are the direct consequences of incompetent and wrong political decisions, I think this is the point where people then will say, wait a moment, why do I now have exactly what you said? Why do I have to bear the burden of something that somebody else deliberately created, and particularly deliberately, even though these are people that swore an oath, I think we tend to forget this, that swore an oath, right, to reduce hardship and to as it is the case in the German oath of office, right, kind of to avoid hardships and increase the well-being of the German people. And what we see in Germany is exactly the opposite. And I think this is increasingly starting to bother people, because the crisis you describe, right, is a direct consequence of energy policies of the last, let's say, three decades. There is no way around it. If you shut down fossil fuels, if you shut down nuclear power, right, if you shut down all the reliable sources of energy and electricity production and try to compensate officially with wind and solar, but inefficially, you do it via imports of energy from Russia. First of all, you lied to your people. You were completely delusional in your risk assessment. And now, thirdly, coming back to what you said, and now you ask the people whom you brought into the situation and kind of almost say, in moralistic terms, well, now to defend freedom and to defend democracy, this is a sacrifice they say we have to bring. But I mean, I'm asking you, right? What sacrifice exactly are they bringing? I'll give you one example. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, right? I assume it was in the Elysee Palace, right? A beautiful building. I mean, architecture, there are not many places as beautiful as Paris in this world. So he is in this palace and gives a speech where he says, we have to accept the age of abundance is over. Now hard times are coming. Sacrifices are necessary. And I believe that even in France, people say, so what sacrifices are you actually making?
That's right.
Like, what sacrifices is the political class making? What sacrifices is the also, I have to admit, in the journalistic realm, what sacrifices are they making? And if you look back in history, these are not small issues. If you look back in history, like take World War One or World War Two, right? You know that Theodore Roosevelt lost, I think it was either his favorite nephew, but I think it was actually his son. Right? He lost his son in World War One. We know that not a politician I commend in other areas, but you know, Stalin's sons served in the Red Army during World War Two. So it was absolutely common that the inner circle of the most powerful people in one way or another were involved in these national emergencies to the point very often of, you know, sacrificing their lives. But people will ask now, so which sacrifice is the Macron family going to make? Which sacrifice is the Scholz family going to make? I don't think there will be many sacrifices. And this is the question that bothers me. You cannot ask people for sacrifices if you yourself are not demonstrating or willing to demonstrate that you are willing to do the same. And this is, I think, the dynamite that Europe is sitting on. Because if the people, and the United States, by the way, as well, if the people have the feeling that there is such a huge gap between, I know this term is old-fashioned, but I use it nonetheless, between the ruling class, the ruling elite, and the everyday lived experience of the people. I mean, they are lucky that most Europeans are so old, right? It's very hard to get an old population to become revolutionary.
Right.
But you can also not completely rule it out. But at some point, these people, that the frustration that exists will find a way to express itself. And I do not think that we are prepared for the potential forms this expression could take on. But this is, I think Europe was never closer to a true political revolt than it has been in decades. So I think we still don't see what's brewing there potentially.
Rolf, again, I think you really touch on another significant point that too often when we look at the word sacrifice from this political spectrum, I think there's a common misunderstanding that sacrifice means unity. But one thing that it's crystal clear is, again, going back to what you said, we never identify who are the subject to be sacrificed. So in other words, politicians or the head of the government, again, not just in Germany, but when we look at, you know, for example, the economic crisis in Sri Lanka these days, the president and the prime minister just actually pick up and then just left. So in other words, the people in Sri Lanka, this storm into presidential palace, I'm sure that because the frustration, because the anger that they fell inside. So in other words, no one would like to be the scapegoat for any other people's wrongdoing or ruthless behaviors. Now, I want to get to the end of last part of the conversation. I know, Rolf, your time is very precious. Now, going back to the U.S., again, this is something that your research touched on extensively as well. And again, I want to read something that you tweeted not too long ago, and I quote, "Western decline, it's entirely self-inflicted. A strong alliance in more than names only," you know, again, you name start to different countries, "would be unmatched economically, militarily, and also in its innovative power." Now, Rolf, help us understand. We know that because the pandemic and because the war in Ukraine or any other reasons that we can find, the countries are today facing much greater jeopardy than ever, economically speaking and also politically speaking. But people are still looking up towards the U.S. So in other words, remember, this is one of the sounding capitalistic countries. And this is one of the, I want to say, the role models for this democratic system. But ironically, people believe U.S. it's actually in decline, or U.S. is actually, I want to be careful, if we put in a very simple term, is tracing itself or pushing this old wagon all the way back to the farm, not actually being innovative or not actually pushing forward. Rolf, help us to understand what is happening in the Western Hemisphere today in terms of this political or this economic aspect. And also, meanwhile, the second question is, how can we expect not just the U.S., but the countries such as China, India, any other countries can actually pull themselves back on the track in order to maintain this unity in a decent way?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think there's a lot to unpack here. One thing I would say, it always depends how you look at these issues. One is, but you could probably make the argument that all the major players in the world are currently in decline, right? Mm. I share your assessment of the United States, but if we look at Russia, like Russia is in many ways demographically, economically, despite their war efforts, but invading a neighboring country alone doesn't make you a great power. Exactly. I mean, there's another point I want to make in a second, right? I think that this is, I think more so in the West than I think in other countries, this is the huge misunderstanding of imperialism, right? Imperialism doesn't make you powerful. It is power that allows you to be imperialistic. Mm. So it starts domestically and then you expand, right? Rome had an empire because they were very good at what they were doing when they were still small, right? Mm. We had an Islamic empire because after another theologian, so I cannot say to what extent it is factually true, but whether I don't know if God or that the Archangel Gabriel did talk to Muhammad or not, but he obviously thought that it happened, and that allowed him then to build the structures that allowed the emergence of an Islamic empire. And I think, again, we can go through this. I mean, Chinese history is full of these stories. That's right? I mean, if you look at the great reformer, I forgot which dynasty it was, but you know, Sheng Yang is one of the major reformers in China. And he built a strong state, which then was capable of conquering other states because they did things better than others. So I think this is always the question we have to ask. So what are the domestic conditions in countries? And I think then we can make an assessment of whether or not these countries are capable of, as you said so beautifully, kind of staying on course for the future. So, for example, I cannot tell you because I don't know. So this is you know, pure conjecture. I don't know to what extent, for example, the people in China, you know, feel bonds of solidarity, right? What kind of, I don't know the main characteristics, let's say, of Chinese nationalism. Mm. But my argument would always be, let's assume that these, just for the sake of the argument, let's assume that these ties are really strong. Mm. If these ties are really strong, I don't think that on the long run, the demographic problems, the real estate bubble, all these problems will be lethal to China. Mm. And the reason why I'm saying is, because the West experienced the Great Depression in the 20s and the 30s, right? We experienced two world wars. So there were plenty extremely destructive events. But as long as kind of the basic capacity and capability for collective action, right, for cooperation, for efficient cooperation, or as social scientists who say, as long as social capital and mutual trust was high, you can come out in maybe not better, but in decent shape out of these conflicts. Mm. And I think that is the great question, right? So what are the underlying factors here? And this is what I see crumbling in Europe. I see it crumbling in the United States. And this is what I meant when I said it is self-inflicted, because that's primarily a cultural issue. If you tell people, and I say again, I think that particularly China is very well aware of this, even though they don't talk about it.
Mm.
If you tell people that what you mentioned before, that individual autonomy is everything, that the community only exists to benefit the individual, right? That nationalism is bad, that religion is bad, that the history of your country is bad. Right? If you tell people all these things, you do create a society where people are only loyal to themselves.
Mm.
And that's, you cannot be a global player with such an attitude. Who is going to fight? And we see this. If you look at recruitment numbers for the U.S. military, they cannot meet their quotas, which makes absolute sense.
That's right.
Why would you fight for a collective when everybody tells you it's, you know, the collective is bad, what it stands for is bad? So why would you do this? And I think you see this, for example, again, in China, right, that they are very aware that they would not allow anything like what we generally call wokeness or political but to emerge for that very reason. Again, I'm not saying that China is generally my model. I'm neither a China dove nor a China hawk. But I think that they do realize more than others the importance of culture.
Mm.
And this is I think this is, we have so internalized this that we don't even ask the question, isn't it possible that human existence is not, going back to what you said at the beginning, that human existence is not culminating in becoming, you know, on an individual basis, whatever you want to be, this idea of complete individual autonomy? Or could it be that it is actually the essence of you know, human existence is being part of a community, is being part of a larger entity that continues its existence in history, even if you and I are long gone? I mean, I think we need to have this discussion, because I say this now with carefulness, I don't want to get into hot water here, but it is no coincidence that all of a sudden a society that has demolished these traditional forms of identity comes up with all these, you know, new gender identities. And I mean, we're not just talking about, you know, heterosexual and homosexual and maybe intersexual or transsexual. We have all these now, you know, non-binary I think it's like 56 different genders.
That's
these
right.
Kind of things.
That's right.
That's a psychological. That's not real. There are. I mean, I say this in all carefulness. Let me say it this way. I'm not sure if there really are 56 different genders. Right? I find the evidence for this very, very unconvincing. So if somebody tells me they identify as, I think there is one, it's a little bit funny as well, right? They identify as a cat. That doesn't make them a cat, right?
Right.
But it demonstrates we are a society so devoid of meaningful identities that you know, people pick these kind of things. And there is war zone. Because you have another, just real quick, because in Europe, you have a second phenomenon, which is we had a lot of migration from Muslim parts of the world.
Mm.
And of course, they are now becoming more religious because they don't want to be cat people, but they say, wait a moment, I have something in kind of, you know, an ace up my sleeve, which is my old identity, my religious identity. Mm. So they reinforce that identity. And this is for me always the thing. And then you have what we talked before, right? And then you have kind of the third big on, which is the skies, the heaven is going to fall, the world is going to end. Environmental climate panic identity is another form. But for me, this always comes back to, not entirely, right, but in many ways to matters of identity.
Ralph, I want to wrap up our conversation by ending a very simple question. Again, when we look at the world today, the war in Ukraine and this political and also this economic disengagement between China and the US at this moment, and also this standoff at the border between India and China, of course, the economic crisis in Sri Lanka, the upcoming election across the continent. But meanwhile, people say, or some experts believe, that because we have war, because the world is undergoing some major transactions or major transition, war, conflict, actually is going to make the world much stronger. Now, I want to get your reaction on this. Is this rather ridiculous to believe that conflicts or a war or any type of disputes, regardless political or economic aspects, can actually shake up or reshake the system of the world, or we should find a new meaning, or we should learn to define what is happening in the world today in a fresh new way? What do you think? Which argument is valid? If neither, how would you interpret everything going on regarding the word war, conflict, disagreements, or political disengagement, everything we're seeing today?
Oh, this is a fantastic question, and one that I've wrestled with for a long time. The kind of early 20th century philosopher William James once wrote a short essay with the title "The Moral Equivalent of War," and what he described in this essay was exactly what you kind of are getting at. Is he said, "Can we create conditions where people cooperate, work together, right, have this sense of meaning?" As they seem to have during times of war, without having actual war, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to deny. I mean, this is not, nobody wishes for war, but of course it's very hard to deny that there is a certain, how to put this, existential threat. So let's put it this way, mm-hmm. right? They tend to end some of the, let's call it, more eccentric, decadent elements of a society. Again, I'm not, to be very clear, I'm not saying I'm wishing for it. Mm. But if you're in the front lines, let's say, and it doesn't matter which country it is, right? I think many things that we care about now, again, particularly in the West, I think they would very soon, very easily start to look ridiculous. Mm. So there is this. I mean, you see this a little bit via proxy with Ukraine. And what I mean by this is there are now so many people in Europe who just, 5 minutes ago had the coexist bumper sticker on their car and arms are for hugging. War is never an answer. And these are now exactly the people who have little Ukrainian flags in their social media profile. And they say, we need to deliver more weapons and faster. And, Ukraine must fight until they... Again, I'm happily supporting Ukraine. But I think the motivation for many people is exactly what you described, right? That they can... is that always a word? That they can participate in an existential struggle, but don't really have to be part of it, right? Mm-hmm. It's you show your support. It's like the Christian, if you want, and again, I mean this in a positive way. It's like the Christian who wears the cross, right? They symbolize their partaking in the sacrifice that Jesus has made, but they are not expected to themselves be nailed to the cross. And I think it's a similar thing we see in this conflict, right? I show my support for Ukraine. I show myself to then be part of this existential struggle of standing on the right side of history, if you want. But nobody is really expecting me as an Austrian in disguise, right, to pick up a weapon and go to Ukraine. So there is, and the state is okay, but I mean, this is, we have an open conversation here. So I think we must realistically admit that, yes, these existential conflicts can have certain effects, right? And I think this is something we should not simply ignore. I mean, this does not mean, again, that one wishes for war, but But the competition between nations has that kind of effect. I think that that is undeniable. I mean, this is a little bit the fear, I have to admit, that I have when it comes to the United States and China, which is I don't think that anybody in the Chinese leadership is particularly interested in a war with the U.S., not even over Taiwan or anything. But it could be the case that as nationalist sentiment is on the rise in China, right, that some hot-headed individuals or hot-headed group is saying, no, we have had enough, this is our moment, and then you have gradual escalation, and before you know it, you end up in a shooting war that no side necessarily really wanted. So that, and the same is true. Now, people might say, so Ralph, what are you saying? Are you putting blame on China? No, that is not my intention. Mm. But the Chinese know, and I think we here know as well, Western society got used to a certain level of comfort. So so I think it's easier to you know motivate people for armed conflict in countries that have not yet you know made themselves comfortable, to quote Francis Fukuyama, in the end of history. I mean, you see this in Western Europe. Mm. Nobody in Western Europe is, and we have polls that show that. So again, this is not me making this up, that nobody is willing to die for their country. And this is just real quick to go back to your previous question. That's a consequence of individualism. Mm. If only I count, and not the generation before me, not the generation after me, and if my country is pretty much only a huge machine for redistribution, that supports me in getting the best possible material outcomes for myself, no, I'm probably not going to be willing to die for that country. I also, by the way, will not be willing to have children. And this is exactly what you see, right? This is a very, I mean, it's a sad development. I like the world. I like multiple cultures. I think that the world is richer for the existence of the Chinese people, of the Indian people, of the Italians, of the French, you know, even the Germans. I think this all makes the world an exhilarating and exciting place. So I think it's sad to see the Japanese as well, right? I think it's sad to see these cultures and these people disappear. But this is, I still think this is in many areas what's going on, unless you have this kind of existential conflict that you know reinforces these kind of sentiments. And as a last add on to this, and this is I think what people misunderstand. Again, this is of course my personal opinion, but I think this is what so many misunderstand, that the potential driving force between a larger conflict is not so much where the oil is or where the coal is or where the semiconductors are. I think it's more the growing, and yet I think it's growing, but I can be wrong, right? And hopefully I'm wrong. That if there is a growing desire to find, you know, the reinforcement of your existence, right? Kind of that you want to be part of an existential struggle. I mean, again, this is what the environmental movement is. Mm. The world is not going to end tomorrow.
Right.
But if I believe that the world is going to end tomorrow, then I'm part of this struggle. So if we assume that that one part of the population goes for the existential struggle in environmentalism, but if another part of the population goes for an existential struggle, you know, for nationalism, and the same happens in China, and the same happens in India, I think then these cultural factors potentially push us much closer to war than any, you know, geographical factor. I mean, just as a last point on this, the border conflict between India and China, like the disputed area, this area is not it's important, but it's not like of vital interest for either China nor India. Like it's not that whoever controls, pardon me, this piece of land controls Central Asia.
Right.
That's not how it is. But it's a matter of honor, right? It's a matter of dignity. And no side wants to appear weaker towards the other side. And I believe this is also, of course, something that will, for the foreseeable future, prolong the conflict in Ukraine. Because this is no longer just about
right
geographical extension. This is about, you know, the both sides, and I think justifiably so in the Ukrainian case, that they say, you know, you guys tried to conquer us, you guys invaded us, and now it's time for payback. And on the Russian side, they of course say, we started this invasion, we have to continue, otherwise we're going to look weak. So
right,
this is, you know, when you hear people say we need a diplomatic solution, it's very hard because both sides at the moment have very strong psychological incentives to reject any diplomatic solution, particularly if both sides believe that they can still win this thing.
And I think, Rolf, again, if I can try to replace the word that you were saying, it's not about growth. It's not just about growth. I think at the end of the day, it's the word maturity. Now, the maturity of the leadership and the maturity of the country. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor to speak to Dr. Rolf Schulhammer. And again, Rolf works as assistant professor of international relations at Webster Vienna Private University. Rolf, thank you so much for taking your time to join the show. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. And again, we really appreciate your insights and analysis. We love to have you back on the show for our future episodes as we continue to follow the progress and also the changes within the international community. Thank you, Rolf.
This was beautiful. Thank you so much. Anytime again.